From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, has written his first novel. It's based on his observations reporting from Sarajevo when it was under siege. The main character is a teenage girl who becomes a sniper after Serb soldiers rape her and brutalize her father. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Scott Simon about his novel and the real teenager who inspired the main character. Also, we talk with Linda Greenhouse, who covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Her new book is about the late Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. We'll hear how writing the landmark decision Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion, changed his life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. From the This Is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. Listeners to Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, already know he's a terrific writer. He's written several books, but now he's written his first novel. It's called Pretty Birds, and it's inspired by his experiences reporting from war zones, especially Sarajevo. He filed a series of reports from Sarajevo in 1993 and 94 while the city was under siege. Sarajevo, which prided itself on being a cosmopolitan and multi-ethnic city, came under attack by the Serbs. During the siege of Sarajevo, the residents had to scrounge for food, burn furniture to keep warm, live in destroyed homes, and dodge sniper bullets. The main character in the novel, Irena, is loosely based on a real teenager named Irena, who Scott reported on during the siege. In the novel, after Serb soldiers force the family out of their home, rape Irena, and beat up her father, she becomes a sniper targeting Serbs. Let's start with a short reading.
As this scene opens, my protagonist, Irena Zarich, who is a teenager who has become a sniper, is sitting in her roost on her side of the divided city of Sarajevo. I note that the Malaka River, which had once tied the city together like a ribbon, now divided it like the edge of a serrated knife. And, you know, she hasn't been a sniper for very long. And as she sits in her roost, sizing up an opportunity to get off a shot, these are some of the thoughts that go through her mind. Irena observed certain rules. She'd been taught a few and kept a few more for herself. Tedic, her chief, had told her not to shoot at children. The morals were dubious and the publicity devastating. On her own, Irena had determined that she would not shoot at pets. Tedic had instructed her not to shoot at grandmothers, and when she wondered if grandfathers were included by the same logic, he reminded her that Milosevic and Karadzic could have grandchildren. Tedic had also directed Irena not to shoot at squatters. He said they weren't worth the waste of a bullet or the risk of revealing herself. Serbs reviled squatters as bothersome bumpkins and pests. Their loss would cause no inconvenience or remorse. Why should we clean out their rats' nests, he asked. Irena decided that she would not shoot at someone who looked like Sting, the Princess of Wales, or Katarina Witt. She wanted to be able to enjoy looking at their pictures without seeing ghosts. She would not shoot at someone who was already wounded, though she would judge if someone limped because he had been truly wounded or because he had jammed his toe kicking a plugged-up toilet. Irena knew that Tedic would have a score of sensible objections to each of her rules. What if Serb snipers started tucking puppies under their arms? What if a Serb mortar team carried a little ginger cat as their mascot? Would she shrink from firing at a Serb setting off an artillery piece if he had eyebrows like Katarina Witt? Irena kept her rules in confidence so that she could not be reasoned out of them. She already knew that when the bullet she fired singed the air, they sailed under their own authority.
That's Scott Simon reading from his new novel, Pretty Birds. What did you want your main character to be, a sniper?
I wanted my main character to be someone who resists. And I must say, I was fascinated by the stories that I heard people recounting women snipers. And I was just intrigued at the possibility of being able to kind of recreate, and both imagine and recreate the kind of lives they lived during that period. And I wanted a character who, while initially, as everybody was just flabbergasted and aghast at what was happening, I wanted a character who, in reasonably short time, would see it as her responsibility to resist the madness that was grabbing her city by the throat.
How much is your character, Irena Zarich, based on the real woman, Irena Milic, who you reported on in 93 and 94 when you were reporting for NPR from Bosnia?
I would say about 15%. The name certainly
Boy,
is...
Boy, I like how you actually came up with a number.
it's been on my mind for a couple of years now. Uh-huh. Certainly the name, but the name is a tribute to Irena Milic, the real-life person. Certain details of her life and her family's life, like her father, as in the book, and certainly in real life, became a dedicated candle maker. He would take the residue of candles that had burned down and smush it together and melt it and try and make another new candle, self-sustaining taper. and he was quite proud of that. And certainly details of the way they lived in almost every Sarajevo, burning furniture to try and keep warm, sometimes to have light, eating grass soup, that sort of thing, and certain physical details of certainly the way she looked. But that's just about 15%. At some point, if a novel succeeds, you take another character and you create another character in your mind. You just begin with the set of inspiration. But she inspired it, but she is not that character. I don't know if you noticed this. You know, there's a scene fairly early on. Irina Zarić, my protagonist, is a high school basketball star. And as the war is beginning, her team is just getting ready for the spring tournament. And they have an assembly where their principal, Ms. Ferens, is revving up the crowd and saying, and she introduces the team and says, and then there you hear them, Serbian names, Bosnian names, Muslim names, Croat names, even Jewish names, all of the names of our city, the names of each and every person in Sarajevo. We play for everyone in Sarajevo, and it's kind of an emotional scene. And did you notice Ms. Ferens, the principal?
What about her?
Well, she looks like you.
Are you kidding?
Not at all. No, I needed to keep a character in my mind, and you were it.
Oh no! I have to go to the page now. What page are we talking? So I could get right.
I was rereading the book, but you know these things. I mean, I haven't had the prose in my hand until the book came out. So I was going through the book, because I had to remind myself of what's in there, and you know you do forget things. Let me see where Miss Ferens is. Page 16, okay?
Okay.
Just a week earlier, the school principal, Miss Ferens, had introduced the men's and women's basketball teams at a school assembly in the gym. She presented the players by position and declared, "There you hear it, Serb names, Croat names, Muslim names." She turned slightly toward Birja Misukovic and kept her lips above the microphone. Well, I won't go on that. Actually, there's not much physical description in here, so much as it was in my mind. The principal continued in a soft tone, "Serbs, Croats, Muslims, Jews, they are all our family names here in Number 3 High School in Grbavica. Different names, different histories. Today," Miss Ferens fairly thundered, "we all play for the same team, our team, just like every citizen of Sarajevo." And then, "Let's show all Bosnia." Miss Ferens turned her right arm above her head as if she were ringing a bell. Her glasses slipped down her nose. "Muslims, Serbs, Croats, Jews, Rastas, Hindus," but she goes on and on. Terry?
I see the resemblance. She has eyeglasses, so do I. She has a right arm, so do I.
It's, are you turning your right arm right now?
She's a dead ringer for me.
Well, this was the image that I had in my mind as I wrote Miss Ferens. I was still at the point where I needed to have. I think actually, having interviewed a lot of novelists over the years, as certainly you have, I think they all say they do have to have someone in mind, whether if it's someone they know well or someone they just saw in passing on a bus. And Miss Ferens was the image, or you were the image I kept in my mind for Miss Ferens.
Well.
Forgive me if I'm sure in the editing process my references to her startling fawn-like beauty got dropped as distracting, but damn editors.
So who else have you used as images in your mind in writing the book?
A lot of people who I think whose names may and sometimes may not be recognizable to your audience. I mean, it's a lot of people on our staff. I have a scene where people in the Zarić's apartment building have to take refuge in the basement of the building as the Serb assault on the city is beginning, and people are coming through with guns and mortars. And every character in that basement is a member of our staff on Weekend Edition, because I needed some physical description. I have a character who's an operative agent. Her stage name, if you please. We never know her really name is. Her real name is Jackie, and physically, in terms of her presence, she's somewhat modeled on my colleague Jackie Lydon.
Huh.
And I don't want to give a plot point away, but there's also an important physical difference between the two. But you know, I learned these are just little glints of suggestions that work their way into your mind so that you can begin to create a character. And often, by the time you're done, the character is very different from the person you began with. And that's as it should be, you know. That's it. It should have that life. I mean, in the end, it was important to me not to even... I had no creative interest in trying to write a book where characters are thinly described. thinly veiled versions right. of someone who exists in real life. I wanted to write a book with real characters.
My guest is Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new novel is called Pretty Birds. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. He's written his first novel. It's called Pretty Birds, and it's based on his observations reporting from Sarajevo during the siege of the city. The Arena in your novel is a sniper.
Yeah.
In one of your reports on the real Arena, the Arena who you reported on in Bosnia, you're mm-hmm. talking to her in the park. Manuli Wetherill, your sound engineer, is with yeah. you. And a sniper starts shooting.
Yeah.
And I want to play that excerpt of this report where the sniper started shooting as you're talking to her in the park. And mm-hmm. this actually starts with you describing what's happened. Here we go.
Okay. We'd begun to pack away our equipment when rifle shots were heard, a common background sound in Sarajevo, along with artillery shells or mortar rounds. But then people in the park began to run. And in Sarajevo these days, nobody runs to lose weight or to catch a bus, only to duck bullets. But we had to pull Arena down onto the ground.
It's tough.
You could stir it up again. Let's just get behind here.
Behind the tree. Behind this tree.
Behind that tree?
Oh, those go down.
Can you finish this?
I think we can finish this interview.
Interview maybe in a hotel.
Yeah, I think we're done.
We have to go to hotel.
I think we're done.
Okay.
Everybody's moving again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when we were changing tapes and the firing started.
Yeah.
Manoli and I hit the ground like a flash.
Because you had to, save your life.
Yeah, but why did you still sit up there on that?
Because I don't afraid anymore. I used to that, you know. You understand, because also this sniper, you know?
Yeah.
Behind my building, sometimes the whole day, you know, it's shooting, you know?
I know.
And I just run, you know, but I don't care about my life. I don't give a damn shit about it.
Come on. Now, I don't want you to sound just like a almost 16-year-old who's trying to be brave and, oh, I'm so tough. Mm-hmm. Of course your life's important.
Yeah, everybody's life is important, of course. We all want to live, you know. But sometimes my parents were scared, you know. They said, what are you doing? Come here to the basement, you know. You can get killed. I said, go to hell. I don't care about that, you know. I believe in fate, you know. I believe in fate. And
Irina.
If I have to die, I'll die.
Irina.
Yeah.
I admire you, but that's the first dumb thing I've heard you say.
I'm sorry, but that's my opinion. You know.
That's a report by Scott Simon in Sarajevo was this 1993, Scott?
Yeah, that sounds right, 1993. Probably would have been the fall of 1993.
You know, I love the way you say to her after she's telling you about she doesn't give a damn about her life anymore, and mm-hmm. you tell her you don't want her to sound like one of those 16-year-olds who's trying to act tough and sound brave. How much of it do you think was a pose, and how much of it do you think was a kind of attitude that a lot of people adopt just out of, like, mental self-preservation?
I think it was a pose that a lot of people adopt out of mental self-preservation, to tie those nicely together. I don't think you could have gone on about your life, I don't think people did, without sometimes taking on a pose that would let them get through to the next scene, whether the next scene was to stand in line where they would be exposed to sniper fire for water or for one of the humanitarian packages of food, or to... for that matter, get across a driveway where they could hope to slip into a basement when bombardment began. I think you sometimes have to make a pose to convince yourself to do something. Irena was going through, Well, when I say Irena was going through a very bad period, I mean, this, you know, the language. The city was going through a bad period. And when I talk about a bad period, I'm just not obviously talking about conventional teenage angst, but the assault that was encircling the city and threatening the lives of everyone. And she was at a very fatalistic point. But, you know, like not just teenagers, but like anyone, you could talk to her in 3 minutes and she would have a different attitude. But of course, what startled me at that point is that Manoli Wetherill and I had hit the ground, which, by the way, is not necessarily protection against a sniper. But Irena stood, she was sitting on a tree stump, you know, because all the trees at that point in the park had been cut down for firewood and sometimes for the wooden slats of grave markers. And she just sat up there like, you know, shoot me if that's what you're going to do. And, I actually have a character raise this in the book. There was some feeling among Sarajevans, you know, if we weren't so scared, if we stayed inside and more of us showed our faces, the snipers would have more targets and wouldn't know where to begin. So maybe, ironically, we would be safer if more of us just went out in the streets. The problem is if you've only got, 50 or so of us walking around at any one moment, the snipers can pretty much get to everybody if that's what they want to do. But if there were 1,000 of us showing our faces at the same time, maybe they wouldn't know where to begin, and ironically, we'd be safer.
You've structured a lot of reports over the years, and you've written several books, but they were nonfiction books. So mm-hmm. You have a lot of experience in structuring writing so as to effectively and movingly tell a story. But I imagine structuring a novel is a little bit different. Can you talk a little bit about the process that you used to actually figure out where things were going to happen, how you were going to like build the storyline and the sense of drama within that story?
You know, when I began writing, I had, you know, 3 or 4 major characters in mind, maybe an equal number of minor characters. I had in mind maybe 12 kind of incidents or scenes that I wanted to write about, and I pretty much knew the ending. And I must say, I just held my nose and jumped in. I mean, I tried to sketch things out a little bit, but I really discovered where the story led by actually sitting down or standing up. I write standing up. By actually standing up and writing and living with the plot and living with the characters and letting them direct it. You know, and this was an altogether new process for me. You know, in journalism, we often kid and say it would be so much easier if we could make it up. Well, I discovered, no, it's much harder if you have to make it up. You know, we have the items by which we describe someone pretty much available. They're 27 years old. They have dark hair. They wear glasses. This is their name. When you begin to create a character, you almost don't have any of that, or at least you have to arbitrarily or not so arbitrarily decide on any and all of that. And sometimes you have to decide on it in a way you know is going to feed into some other plot point that might be years away in terms of when you're writing a novel. And I didn't know how to do it. I didn't even know how to give my characters names.
Now, we've kidded about this before, Scott, but as a host, you sometimes use very delicate language when referring to anything remotely sexual. Mm-hmm. Now, in your novel, there are passages where you're describing oral sex, the aftermath of a rape. Were those difficult for you to write? Did you have to become a slightly different person or have a different voice, certainly, than the one that you have when you're a host or reporter?
I think one of our staff members is on the other side of the glass here in the studios with me, and he's giving me a sly grin. I think he would tell you that I actually become a different person when I'm on the air. not writing the salty sections of the book. I must say I got some small satisfaction in demonstrating in the novel that I know some words that people would find flabbergasting to hear coming out of my mouth. But it's interesting, those sections. Look, for a man to try and describe, and I think it's impossible to write a valid novel about the war in Bosnia without rape obviously being a feature. I think for a man to write that takes some active empathy and even some research. I have a much more benign oral sex scene, as you note, and I forget how many drafts I went through that before I finally had the nerve to show it to my wife, Caroline, without telling her quite what was coming. And she read through it and told me that it was hilariously misinformed. And, I think typically so for males, where it was her point that we, you know, we had no interest in what they were feeling on the other side. So with her careful and helpful suggestions, that that scene was revised, and I I hope it is now valid.
I'll spare you from describing what her suggestions were.
Yes, well, thank you very much. I think she would appreciate that too. But oh well. And in any event, I was, you know, yet that was all part of why I wanted to write a novel. I must say, at the same time, the whole chance to put yourself in somebody else's skin, the whole chance to take on another identity, to try and see the world through somebody else's eyes. That's all part of what I wanted to do. That was all part of the creative challenge of writing a novel.
Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new novel is called Pretty Birds. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin. Available in stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine reports on how arts education is being used to boost student achievement in Texas schools at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, New York Times Supreme Court reporter Linda Greenhouse talks about her new book on the life of the late Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. She'll tell us how writing the Roe v. Wade decision changed his life. And we continue our conversation with Scott Simon about his new novel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Over the years, he's reported from 10 war zones. He's just written his first novel, and it's based on his reports from Sarajevo during the siege of the city. The novel is called Pretty Birds. In your novel, there's a point where the jihadists start to move in to support the Muslims in Sarajevo. Mm-hmm. One of them says, "The West sends blue helmets and dried beans. We bring you guns and men. Sarajevo will become a monument to God and his prophet. Sarajevo will be Mecca." When you were reporting from Bosnia, did you meet any of the jihadists who had come in to fight with and for the Muslims? And if so, did you see them then as heroes or as extremists?
We did nothing more than shake hands with a few of the people who came in from Saudi Arabia, as I recall. So I did not engage in any conversations with them. And the Sarajevans I knew, for the most part, were, if I might describe them this way, secular Muslims. And I wouldn't for a moment suggest this didn't mean they weren't serious about their faith, but I think some of the superficial ways of observing that faith that people fix on and you know, in terms of obviously offering prayer time during the day and certain items of dress and behavior, they didn't think that was important in terms of registering their Muslim identity. So they were secular. I mean, I still I didn't know them, but a lot of the Sarajevans would talk about coming up against the jihadists, and they, you know, they had. I think a mixed reaction. On the one hand, it was the only help that was really coming into the city that was of any, at least military, consequence at that point. On the other hand, I think they thought that the jihadists, the people coming in from elsewhere, had their own agenda. And while that part of the agenda that wanted to see Sarajevo survive was something that could help them, they thought they might have some other disagreements down the road. And there were even just the superficial, I think, social differences that they had when they would sometimes come into town because, you know, the Sarajevans drank beer and the Sarajevans sipped coffee and the Sarajevans were cosmopolitan and... cosmopolitan and effervescent in a way they felt the jihadists weren't. And, you know, then, of course, there were reports that were coming in from the interior of the country about jihadists that would, to their credit, I suppose, prevail and win a battle and help the Bosnian army win somewhere, but also at the same time drive out Serbian groups, drive out Serbian families in a way they thought was all too much an imitation of ethnic cleansing. And that made a lot of people uncomfortable.
One of your reports from Sarajevo for NPR had to do with pets, people who have pets in Sarajevo,
mm-hmm.
and how even though you're at war and it's hard to find food, you still find food for your pet. You still take care of your pet. You still love your pet. And there's an important pet in your novel. It's a pet parrot.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering why it was important to you to have that parrot in the book.
I love animals, and animals are an important part of my life, and I enjoy writing about animals, and I love the identification that animals and human beings can have together. I think of all the stories we did in Sarajevo, nothing brought more reaction than the stories Manoli and I did about what people went through to take care of their pets in Sarajevo, because in the end, of course, they didn't see it as just taking care of their pets, but taking care of an aspect of their own humanity. So I remembered the connection that made with people and had certainly made that connection with me. It's one of the things I cherished about Sarajevo, and so it seemed natural to me that I should put it in the book. Now, in a story we did with Irena Milic and her family, the young woman to whom this book, one of the three people to whom this book is dedicated and was the inspiration for the principal character, she talked about releasing their family's parrot, who was not named Pretty Bird, which is the name I give the parrot. I don't recall the name of their parrot, if even we knew it. But talked about that the terrible moment came. They had a parrot who was greatly beloved, and the parrot just wouldn't eat after several weeks. And a veterinarian explained to them that there are just some parrots that can't make the transition from seed to leftover crumbs of other food that they can share, human food, if you please. And so it was a heartbreaking moment when they had to wait for a lapse in the sniper fire and go up to the roof of an apartment building in which they were squatting at that point and let the parrot go and hope that the parrot would fly to the Serbian side of the city and somebody would say, "My gosh, what a beautiful bird. Why don't we take that bird home?" It was the only hope that they had to save their pet's life, their bird's life, except, of course, by taking that chance that they could do something that would help the bird to survive. It meant leaving, literally flapping out of their lives. And as so often happens, Irena and her mother register an emotional reaction to seeing the parrot fly away that they haven't permitted themselves to register when they've seen anyone close to them die. Because you're very conscious, obviously in the middle of a war in particular, of not being able to give vent to that kind of emotion, because in a sense that opens the door to vulnerability. But there's something about animals that can be literally disarming emotionally to us. And so when they let the parrot go, all of the emotions that they've been stored, that they've been storing inside, have the opportunity to come tumbling out.
What is the real Irena, the Irena that inspired the character of Irena in your new novel? What is she doing now?
We have to keep that private.
Oh. Okay.
Nothing, not international drug running or anything like that, but we just have to have agreed to keep that private.
Okay, that's fine. When was the last time you were in Sarajevo, Scott?
In Sarajevo a couple summers ago. I had not been back, I was not there for the end of the siege. When I left the city was still under siege, so I hadn't been back since the war, and my wife had never gone there. And I was in the middle of, actually in the early part of writing the book, I'd taken a month off, and my wife and I were in Europe to do that, and we thought it was important to go to Sarajevo. So it would have been the summer of 2003.
And one of the characters in your novel says, all we wanted in Sarajevo was to be left alone to smoke and drink, stay up late and listen to jazz, ski and screw, and otherwise pursue this brilliantly irrelevant mixed culture we have built over five centuries. So judging from the last time you were in Sarajevo a couple of years ago, are the people there left alone now to drink and smoke?
And all the rest. Well, the world is intruded. You know, there's still a peacekeeping force, United Nations authorized peacekeeping force that's in Sarajevo, and so there are Italian soldiers and some French soldiers, and I forget actually how many nationalities. So the world has opened up more. I also think, look, it's still a place of marvelous diversity and vitality, but it's a lot smaller than it used to be, even by half. Many of the Serbs who were quite happily living in Sarajevo and quite bravely identifying themselves as Bosnians and stayed in Sarajevo through the worst of the siege, for one reason or another, I think, after peace and the Dayton Peace Accords, where the country was essentially divided up into ethnic fiefdoms, a lot of those Serbs have decided to leave, just figuring they'd be more comfortable in other parts of the country. And that's certainly a loss to the city. And you know, if you concentrate on it, you can feel that. I also think that there's no way of becoming what you were before. The wounds of war are raw. The trauma is still with people. And when I note that attitudes have hardened, I think there's more of a kind of hardline religious fundamentalism in the city that wasn't so apparent when we were there during the war, because Iran has come in with a lot of money and has built a couple of trophy mosques, because I think it's important to the mullahs in Iran to be able to demonstrate their fealty, and they have some prime real estate right downtown along the Malacca River, which enabled them to do that. And I think there is a palpable sense of gratitude. And I also think some Muslims in Sarajevo felt, look, when we thought we were so European, and we thought that Europe accepted us as being European, Europeans that happened to be Muslims. But when the crunch came, Europe and the United States and the United Nations and the rest of the world turned their backs on us. And it underscores for us the fact that in the crunch, we can rely only on ourselves and our fellow Muslims.
We've talked in the past, Scott, about what it was like for you as someone who had been a pacifist to report from Sarajevo and find yourself starting to really support military intervention, and deciding that there were times when being a pacifist wasn't you thought the morally correct position, and you wrote, "I'm not willing to lose lives for the sake of ideological consistency." Now that you went through a period several years ago where you changed your mind about, you know, being an ideologically consistent pacifist, is it harder to return to a pacifist point of view again?
Well, I don't return to a pacifist point of view, although I have great respect for pacifism and what pacifism can accomplish in the world. Gandhi's peaceful revolution in India points to the power of pacifism. And I think most prominently in the lives of many Americans was the extraordinary struggle for civil rights in this country. So I certainly understand the power of what pacifism can accomplish. But as a reporter, I've also been in places where I think the logic of pacifism doesn't work to protect the lives that are necessary. And in a place like Sarajevo, Which, by the way, the Bosnian government had, you know, they hoped to be what they called the Costa Rica of the Balkans. They wanted to be an unarmed state. And they figured that if they were essentially unarmed, no one would have any interest in attacking them. And that dream and that fiction, I might put it, was dispelled within the first few hours of their existence. And I just could not see any pacifist alternative in the siege of Sarajevo. It ultimately would have meant the city would have been overwhelmed by the worst murderers and thugs, and the best people, the most peaceful people, would have died because of it. And that's just not a result that I could accept.
Well, Scott, congratulations on your novel. Thanks so much for talking with us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. His new novel is called Pretty Birds. You can hear his 1993 report about pets in Sarajevo on our website, freshair.com. Coming up, New York Times Supreme Court reporter Linda Greenhouse talks about her new book on the life of the late Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote the decision Roe v. Wade. This is Fresh Air. Over 30 years after the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade legalized abortion, Americans are still divided over it, and opponents are hoping it will be overturned. The decision was written by Harry Blackmun, who served in the Supreme Court from 1970 to 1994. He died 5 years after leaving the court. My guest Linda Greenhouse has written a new book about him called Becoming Justice Blackmun. It's based on his personal papers, correspondence, and case files. Greenhouse has covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times since 1978 and won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting in 1998. She appears regularly on the PBS program Washington Week in Review. Let's start with the Roe v. Wade abortion decision that Justice Blackmun wrote, a decision that is still not only controversial, perhaps even more controversial than ever. What was the state of the abortion law in the United States when the court agreed to hear Roe?
There was a lot of ferment building up in the country over abortion. It had been the case that abortion had been illegal for many decades in every state, but reform was in the air. New York in 1970 had liberalized its abortion law, making abortion essentially widely available within some limited restrictions. There was a reform effort in California. The attitude toward abortion was changing among the elites in the country, particularly among the medical establishment, which had been very anti-abortion for many years, but had come in recent years leading up to Roe against Wade to see abortion really as a public health issue, that the regime of illegal abortion was putting women in harm's way. There were always going to be unintended pregnancies. There were always going to be efforts to terminate those pregnancies. And the medical establishment had just very recently, before Roe reached the court, the American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, a few other of these leading organizations had changed their policies and started calling for a change in abortion laws. And I think it's important to make that point because I think Roe against Wade has come in the public mind to stand for, women's rights or to sound like some kind of radical departure by the Supreme Court in 1973. And neither of those assumptions is really borne out by the actual history and certainly the record that was in Justice Blackmun's files as he started working on the case.
Justice Blackmun hadn't expressed an opinion before on abortion, and one of the things that he did to help guide and educate him was get back in touch with the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. He used to be the general counsel at the clinic, and he asked them to help him do research on this, and they opened up their library to him. How did that affect his decision?
Well, he was very interested in kind of seeing where what were the roots of the abortion debate in the medical community, what was the medical community's opinion on abortion. He was also very interested in tracking down the roots of the Hippocratic Oath that doctors take, first do no harm, who was it that was being harmed, and so on. So the Mayo Clinic actually volunteered to open its library to him and allow their researchers to do some background work for him, pulling together a lot of the recent articles that were appearing in medical journals about abortion. And he went out there and spent several weeks in the Mayo Clinic library in the summer after Roe against Wade was argued the first time. The court decided there was going to be a re-argument, and so that's the summer that he went out. It would have been the summer of 1972.
Harry Blackmun was pretty new to the Supreme Court when he wrote the Roe decision. How did he become the justice to write it?
He never actually was sure. He was assigned to write it by Chief Justice Warren Burger. The Chief Justice gets to assign an opinion in any case in which he himself is in the majority, and Burger was in the majority in Roe against Wade. In fact, it's worth noting that the vote in Roe against Wade, I think if you ask most people, they'd say, well, it must have been 5-4. It was 7-2. It really reflected a broad consensus on the court, and that's part of why Harry Blackmun was always so puzzled why he became the symbol of abortion in America, why he's the one that got the hate mail and the death threats and so on, because he was assigned the case by the Chief Justice and he spoke for a majority of the court. It's possible that that Berger realized there'd be some flack to take, and maybe Blackmun, being the junior justice, was in the kind of the flat-catching position.
How do you think the language that Justice Blackmun used in his written decision has subsequently framed the debate on abortion?
Well, there's two interesting points to make about the way he wrote Roe against Wade. One is it's clear when you look at it that this was basically a decision about the rights of doctors, to act in what they consider to be their patient's best interest without risking going to jail. There are documents in his papers that indicate he was really very aware of what was happening to doctors. There's an article in his files from an obstetrician from Minnesota named Jane Hodgson, who was an alumna of the Mayo Clinic, and she wrote in the Mayo Clinic Alumni Magazine about her decision to perform an abortion on a patient who had contracted German measles early in pregnancy, and as you recall, that gave a very high risk of serious birth defects, and she performed the abortion knowing it was illegal. It was sort of an act of civil disobedience, but really she was trying to take good care of her patient, and she was charged with a crime, and she wrote about it. And she said in her article, "I look forward to the day when abortion is regarded as a humane service and not a crime." So he really did see a kind of a doctor-centric view. That's one answer to your question. Another answer, of course, is what kind of attention the court paid to the fetus, to the unborn life at stake in an abortion. And the blunt answer is it paid very little attention. And that's been obviously a source of criticism of the opinion ever since. When you look at the briefs that were filed to the court at that time, there really wasn't a whole lot of discussion about fetal life. And that wasn't kind of the framework through which the court, I won't say just Blackmun, the seven members of the majority were looking at all. And in fact, the two dissenters, Justice Rehnquist and Justice Byron White, did not frame their dissents in terms of the interests of the fetus on the other side of the equation, but rather as a dissent from what they viewed as the judicial activism of striking down all the abortion laws in the country. It was more of a critique of the judicial function than of the actual outcome. They, in the private conferences at the court, at least as reflected by the notes that Harry Blackmun took and left in his files, there was really nobody speaking up for the fetal side of the abortion debate, you might say.
Though Blackmun did say the state had two separate and distinct interests in the case. One was protecting the health of the woman, but the other was protecting the potentiality of human life. And he said that the state has an increasing interest as the woman comes to term.
Yes, that's the famous trimester formula that the court set out in Roe. And, you know, it's probably important to say this wasn't something that just popped out of Harry Blackmun's head. It was really a collaborative effort during the months leading up to the final decision among a number of the justices in the majority as to actually how the right to abortion would be implemented in practice. And they eventually came to this decision of the kind of moving framework that in the first trimester, the woman's right is essentially absolute because abortion is safer than carrying a pregnancy to term in the first trimester in the state. Has no regulatory role other than the role it would play in regulating any medical service, you know, a licensed physician and so on and so on. And then in the second trimester, because the medical equation makes the later abortion procedure more risky for the woman, the state can have more strictly medical regulation, not a prohibition, but can have a greater degree of flexibility and regulation. And then in the last trimester, abortion can be prohibited except to preserve the life or health of the pregnant woman.
My guest is Linda Greenhouse. She reports on the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Her new book is called Becoming Justice Blackmun. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Linda Greenhouse. She covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Now she's written a book called Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. You were given access to Harry Blackmun's papers before anyone else in the press was. You got, like, what, a two-month lead on the rest of
right,
the press?
Right, and Nina Totenberg for NPR also. Nina and I both did.
How did this happen?
Well, when Justice Blackmun decided to give his papers to the Library of Congress, which many justices have done over the years, he gave it with the stipulation that the papers could be opened 5 years after his death. And that deadline was in March of 2004. And everybody knew that he had a fabulous set of papers. He never threw anything away. He took notes on everything. So people were really anticipating, you know, what was in there. The Blackmun family was concerned that on the opening day of the collection at the library's manuscript division, it would just be a big circus, you know, a big feeding frenzy kind of thing. And they wanted to avoid that. So they approached me and with a proposition that I could go in there 2 months early, but not write anything at all until the public opening had occurred, at which time I could publish whatever seemed to me to be appropriate to publish. They weren't going to control it at all, but that was the deal.
I think a lot of people now are more likely to, erase their emails or shred their papers than to save them for posterity. Do you think that in the future it's going to be hard to find a collection of papers like Justice Blackmun's?
Well, I think his papers are unusual because he was unusual in his determination to save everything. I think it was more reflects, you know, his personality rather than the time and place, although it's certainly true that the kind of correspondence, the handwritten correspondence that is in these files, it's very unlikely to be taking place today. I think for court papers, for papers generated by the Supreme Court's internal decisional process, those will remain on paper. I think the justices still do that instead of email. But whether individual justices decide to save that stuff and turn it over to the country is going to be a very individual decision. And I think that the prevailing view on the court today is that a collection of papers should remain closed until everybody who that justice has served with has left the court or died. I think several of the incumbent justices have put that kind of stipulation on their papers when they've indicated a desire to give them to some library or other. And many of the justices felt that the 5 years that Blackmun set was too short.
Yeah, well, a lot of the people he served with are, well, everyone he served with is, everyone in the end who he served with is still there.
Except for Breyer, who replaced him, but yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Right. So do you think they're angry that the papers have been released?
Well, you know, angry may be putting it too strongly, but I don't think they liked it at all. And I think, I don't think any of them are going to do the same thing. You know, as it turned out, I think there's nothing in these papers that really is embarrassing to the court institutionally. I really didn't find anything like that. You know, they don't, the incumbent justices, I'm sure, don't like to read about themselves, you know, at all. But given that that was going to happen, I don't think there's anything here that really, you know, made them gnash their teeth all that much other than the simple fact of it occurring.
Well, Linda Greenhouse, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Linda Greenhouse reports on the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Her new book is called Becoming Justice Blackmun. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the hijackers, who they were, why they did it. We talk with Los Angeles Times reporter Terry McDermott about his research into the men behind the September 11th attacks. His new book is called Perfect Soldiers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.